When times are tough.
The world is about to end.
And the world looks bleak.
It was impossible, impossible, impossible.
There is only one man who can save us from ourselves.
The one thing you know when you're born is that you will die.
This is Howard Bloom Saves the Universe.
I believe they believe it, even though I find it very hard to believe that they believe it.
With noted author, speaker, and philosopher, Howard Bloom.
Attention is the oxygen of the human soul.
And now, here's Howard and our MC, Chad Dugatz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Howard Bloom Saves the Universe with Howard Bloom. I am Chad Dugatz, and I am always joined here with Mr. Howard Bloom. Hello, Howard.
Hi, Chad.
And we have a special guest in the studio, and I'm going to let you take this one.
Well, the guest in the studio today is Richard Konigsberg. Richard, say hello.
How are you?
And the reason that we've got Richard on here is because for roughly 20 years, I've been following the tale of how blood seems to be a bonding mechanism. Violence is a bonding mechanism, especially violence that leads to death and lots of blood.
Okay.
It started in The Lucifer Principle, my first book, which I started writing in 1986.
Okay.
And Robert E. Lee said that it is good war is so terrible, or we should grow too fond of it. There was something about war that excited him, that was fun. And I dug out a bunch of other quotes from people who were professional warriors about how exhilarating it is to kill people. And then there was the whole contract, which is a horrible, monstrous, appalling idea. And yet there's some addictive exhilaration, some emotional high in it that pulls the people doing the killing together. Now I've been doing a 10-year update of a book called The Muhammad Code, How a Desert Prophet Brought You ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram, or how Muhammad invented jihad. And when I turned in the manuscript on April 15th, I felt something was missing, the real emotional core of Muhammad's own form of Islam. Now, Muhammad was a guy who led 65 military campaigns. He engineered them. He generaled them. And he personally led 27 of them. And Muhammad said, I would gladly go into battle and be killed, then be resurrected and go into battle and be killed all over again 10 times. In other words, he found something exhilarating, drug-like, about war and blood. And I suddenly realized, thinking of your work, because I've been following your work through your emails for God knows how many years now, that maybe the secret was this bonding power of blood, this incredible addictive exhilaration that takes over when you are busy killing people. So Richard is an expert in all of this.
All right, so I'm going to have to challenge you, let's say,
okay.
Right at the basic category of my work is actually not killing, but dying. And the basic structure of violence from my perspective and in the research I've done, even though it looks like violence, is actually masochistic and sacrificial. So a lot of my work is based on World War I. And if you know a little bit about that war, men got out of trenches for 4 years and ran into machine gun fire. And most of the dying came from people who were shooting machine guns and shooting artillery shells and never saw the people who were dying. So it was not the joy in killing. It was actually the idea that it is sweet and fitting to die for your country. This was an early ideology that came from Horace, and it was passed down almost at the core of Western civilization that it is a good thing to be willing to sacrifice your life for your country.
Okay, so Horace would have been, what, 200 BC, something like that?
A little later, I think.
He was a Roman.
A little later,
so,
I'm not an expert on him, but that phrase.
Right, now what was his phrase?
It is sweet and fitting to die for one's country.
Amazing. Okay. And
Dulce et decorum, you know, I've said it 1,000 times in English. I have trouble with the Latin.
Most people do.
Well, the great cultures were, you could argue, bonded by blood. And what I mean by that is the foundational documents of the Indian civilization, the Vedas, are really about an almost genocidal extermination of the Dravidians, the brown people, who are portrayed as devils in the Vedas. And because they're devils, of course, it's wonderful to kill them. And then there's the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is all about massive killing. How does Achilles expect to be remembered 1,000 years from now by the number of people that he killed? And the Old Testament is another genocidal book. It's about exterminating all of the native peoples living in the land of what we now know as Israel. A horrible, monstrous thing. So you could argue, maybe, or could you, that those three cultural superorganisms were bonded by killing, by self-sacrifice, by what I call blood, or could you? Am I
okay,
way
so,
off base?
So super, I'm not an expert on those particular examples. My
right.
expertise is on World War I, Hitler, and also the Aztecs.
Right.
So one idea I'm going to introduce here that I've been thinking about a lot recently is that there is always an intervening variable in the name of which people die and kill. So you have, you know, violence used to be thought of on this side, you have the killer, and this side, you have the other person
the
that you're fighting, the victim
yeah.
or the enemy,
right.
as my essay says.
Right.
But there's always a third. It's a triadic structure, as my colleague Ruth Stein said. So it has to be done in the name of that object. So everything Hitler did was in the name of Germany. This is what justifies and makes the violence meaningful. Everything the Aztecs did was done in the name of the sun god. Everything that George Bush did was done in the name of freedom and democracy. So they're always... The martyrs in the Middle East, it's done in the name of Allah. There always has to be some super organic, as you said, element or entity that is worshipped and justifies the killing. It's always moral.
Right.
And Hitler said, we may be inhumane, but if we rescue Germany, we have performed the greatest deed in the world. And these men, unlike what the left thinks, are utterly sincere.
Right. No, I agree with you that they're utterly sincere. Let's go back to the Aztecs.
Okay.
So tell me the story of the Aztecs and their use of sacrifice.
Okay. Basically, the Aztecs believed that the world only stayed alive, that the sun only kept on revolving or they thought it revolved around the earth, as
right.
we did for a long time, if it was fed with sacrificial victims, the blood. And this is where the blood comes in, the heart and blood of sacrificial victims. So after a war was over, did they just kill the people, like the Western people that shot them? No, they would bring them to the sacrificial blocks in great, great numbers, pull them up to the top of the pyramid, and in one of the most horrific rituals in human history, cut open the chest, pull out the heart, and give it to the sun god. And that was their theory.
While the heart was still beating and with an obsidian knife. So they
exactly,
were doing this all
exactly,
with a stone knife.
That part
knife.
I can't even think about.
Yeah.
Now, the other interesting
thing. Let's go back to that real fast, though.
Yeah.
Now, these victims, I want to get gory details. These victims.
This is a show about gory details.
So again, my role in this is to be the everyman. These victims or these sacrificial sacrifices. Were they willing? Were they criminals? Who were the people that actually were sacrificed?
All right, very important question. So the Aztecs was only one of, let's say, 13 city-states,
mm-hmm.
okay? So they call Mexico nowadays overall, but it was Aztecs were the famous one, but there was this one and this one and this one. And they fought wars against each other. So the sacrificial victims would be the ones they captured from the other city-state and brought to the sacrificial block. Were they willing or not? Well, they knew it was part of the deal once they became warriors. And by the way, and here's the most fascinating thing about the Aztec warfare that totally contradicts the idea of warfare as a practical thing. When there was no conflict, when the Aztecs had conquered everything, what did they do? Just imagine what they did.
What did they do?
They had the flowery wars. They said, hey, we haven't any sacrificial victims. Let's have a fight. And it wouldn't be gigantic wars like in the West. You know, so 5,000 people from the Aztecs and 5,000 people from the other side, they'd fight the battle and they'd get other victims. It had no purpose other than to capture the soldiers and pull them up. Now, of course, if you're going to get your chest cut open, it's not exactly that fun. You want it.
Yeah.
But you know, they understood that this was their fate. And the Aztecs warriors, when they were captured, they would be sacrificed by the other city-state. So Montezuma said, as the god says, basically, I forget the exact, but it doesn't matter. Right. As long as, you know, either side is sacrificed. And that was something like what happened in World War One.
Well, if I got my history mixed up, they used to have these sunken ball courts, and they had this latex ball, and they were playing a version of what we would call basketball. From what you've said, it sounds like the losing side, the fans of the losing side, would all be sacrificed.
Is that right?
True?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that particular. I know about that ritual. Now, here's another interesting fact. How did Cortez, with like 100, you know, this is one of the great events in history,
men, right?
You know, with 120 men, conquer an entire civilization?
Well, it's a good question, Richard. How did he do it?
Well, apart from the fact they had guns,
right?
The you know, the Spanish would shoot people and bang, bang, you're dead, right? That's the way we did it with the Indians, right? The Aztecs, if they shot a Spaniard, they would drag them back to the sacrificial block.
Right. Well, you would think that that would help them. It would help them terrify the Spaniards. So how did this help them win?
No, it made them more, all the more willing to kill them because it took all their energy and time. Imagine if you're fighting a war and each guy you killed, you had to then take him like 100 yards and sacrifice.
Right.
So they lost.
Yeah, but I don't get it. I don't understand the connection.
Because their idea was not to win.
Yeah.
Their idea was to get sacrificial victims.
Ah.
And that's my radical hypothesis.
Right.
That this is true also for World War One.
Right.
Now, no one has yet, I've studied it for 20 years, it's not like I'm an amateur historian, mm-hmm. has told me why they continued to ask young men, did you see Paths of Glory, the Kubrick film?
No.
You know, you get out of the trench and you run into machine gun fire.
And you're dead in 15
and you're
seconds.
Dead. Exactly. And you know, the historians are totally in denial. They say they underestimated the power of the machine gun.
Right.
And that would account for what? The first week?
Right.
4 years. They kept on doing it.
Right.
So my hypothesis is that none of them were trying to win. They were sacrificial victims. And this is where I was talking about the Galileo business.
Right.
I show this to people who are experienced historians, even films of things that happen. And what do they say? Like Gallipoli, did you see that film?
No.
You don't see many war movies.
I don't see many movies at all.
Oh, okay. Gallipoli was the Australian movie where, again, they actually asked them to get out of trenches without any ammunition, without any guns, with just...
Amazing.
And they all shot them dead.
Right.
And I show this, I have a wonderful colleague, Michael Vlahos, who's a military person. He's been in the military for 30 years. He lost his job recently because for 10 years, 15 years, he'd been telling them that the Iraq war was useless and, you know, they didn't like it. He started saying that in 2003. So anyway, even when I showed him, I sent it out. You can look at your past. People just don't want to look at what was happening.
Right. And what do you think is the real deal that people are not looking at here? Why do you think that this sacrifice, enormous amount of sacrifice of human lives, why do you think that bonds a superorganism, a society, a nation, or a culture, a civilization
together? Why don't they look at it? All right, so there's two.
No, it isn't so much why don't they look at it. It's why does this work as an incredible bonding force? Because, like epoxy, super
okay,
glue.
So if you look at the documentation in my book and anybody who writes about World War One, it's, you know, never has we seen anything so wonderful. This is an Irish revolutionary, Pierce, that so many men giving their lives for their country. Constantly men going in, giving your life for your country. What a wonderful thing. There was a white feather society in Great Britain. People say women are not warriors. Any man of 18 to 24 that was not in the military, they would put a white feather in the back of his head. And they would say, if he won't defend his country, will he defend you? So the idea is that if you are willing to give your life, that means that what you believe in is real. It's I call it a validation. You know, right. This is a scientific idea that it validates the reality. Because no, France must be real, right? If so many people are willing to die for it, and it's the same mechanism with the terrorists. They're dying for Allah.
Martyrs.
They're martyrs.
Yeah, every martyr glues the society together, right?
The martyrdom glues their connection to the superordinate object.
Right.
And that's what, it's not just the glue between people, but it is the glue to America.
Right.
And what's been happening in the United States ever since the Vietnam War is that the sacrificial mechanism has broken down. And I've written about this. Michael has written about this. Right. And that's what happened in the
90s. Michael who?
Michael Vlahos.
Vlahos, okay.
Why didn't we go into Mogadishu? Why didn't we go in Bosnia? There was developed what I call a counter-sacrificial culture in the 90s, where it wasn't worthwhile to die for anything. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
And that was
still going on.
What?
It's still going on.
That counter-sacrificial culture is still there. That's why we use drones. No boots on the ground.
Well, let's see if this sums it up.
Yeah.
So before World War I, none of us remember this. It was before we were born. But before World War I, there had been a long period of peace. It had started in 1814 when the British and the Germans defeated Napoleon, and it had gone on until 1913. And people like Arnold Toynbee were anguishing. They were really upset. They felt that their civilization was becoming soft and was decaying.
Exactly.
And that the only way to give it manliness and virtue was to have a war in which people could go and experience the gloriousness of sacrificing their lives for God knows what, as you said, for superordinate goals, for a superorganismic idea. For a higher purpose. I mean, we all want to be dedicated to a higher purpose. I mean, even the three of us in this room want to be dedicated to a higher purpose. It's just we don't imagine that getting killed
dedicated
is going to help.
Dedicated but not dead.
Yeah, so what you seem to be saying, if I've got this correct, is that when we threw aside the notion of heroism, the idea that the more people you killed
right to the 70s and 80s. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Once we didn't have this business of, 100,000 martyrs or 1 million martyrs or 2 million martyrs shows that we have something worth living and dying for, that our higher purpose is indeed a higher purpose for which we should all be willing to sacrifice. Once we were missing that heroic or hideous notion, we lost the social glue that holds Western civilization together. And we've followed in one of our past episodes the kind of self-doubts that Western civilization has about itself. It's tearing itself to pieces.
Well, Hitler used the term, now you said it is tearing itself to pieces, and I would say it's disintegrating from within. Hitler used the term disintegration continually. And basically what he meant was that this bond to the nation was weakening.
Right.
And that's why he became the greatest sacrificer of all time.
Right.
He wanted to resurrect Germany's greatness, to bring it back to life. And he was conscious of this. He talked about the Germans need to learn to sacrifice. Now, do you know where you're talking about virility? Do you know where that strategy from World War I came from Great Britain?
No clue. Where did it come from?
Remember the Russo-Japanese War in 1905?
Yes.
Okay. So all the military people who were studying that war in 1905, they said the Japanese, the Orientals, are going to be the next great culture. Why? Because they ran into machine gun fire. If you look, there's a movie. When I started studying this was actually in 2000 when I was at the Japan Society, and I saw a movie on this Russo-Japanese War, and I was frightened. They kept on just sending the men, and there they were more conscious. They would say stuff like, the purpose of war is not to win. The purpose of war is to give your life for your country.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. So tell us a little bit about the Russo-Japanese War so we don't leave our Brit listeners in totally dangling.
I mean, again, without even going into the results of it, the Japanese won.
Right.
But they won because they just kept on sending the men, and let's say the Russians ran out of machine gun fire.
Right.
But it's not like, I'm sure there was thousands more killed. But the notion was, again, that they're heroic. They are willing. Whereas, like what you said, the British are getting soft. In the literature, there's always talk about softness. The, you know, now we no longer have the spirit of old. We're not willing to die for our country, and the other countries are going to take over. So we have to resurrect this spirit of sacrifice.
Well, okay, the Russo-Japanese War, just for and see if I've got this right, 1905.
Right.
The Tsar has a problem. His people, the Tsar in Russia, has a problem. And his problem is that his people are not fond of him. They've never really bonded to him for some reason. And he figures that if he can take on some poor, innocent country that is so small that he's guaranteed a victory, that the force that you're talking about, the force of sacrifice, the force of having large numbers of people die in a cause and killing large numbers of people on the other side, and the force of winning a war, is going to pull his people together around him. Okay. And scientific evidence indicates that when you are up against another group in a serious, life-threatening manner, people do bond around the leader. So his principle has been proven accurate by science. So who's he going to pick on? He's got to pick on some people it's too little to win, that just doesn't have a chance of winning. He decides to hit the Japanese. Why? Because the Japanese had a society in which in the 1500s, the Japanese banned the use of modern weaponry. They banned the use of guns. Now, look, they had just come out of an internal war where they had copied the guns that they got from the Dutch and made better guns than the Dutch originally gave them. And they used those guns to pull the country together. This is the 1500s. And then as soon as the big guy, the guy who was managing this war, pulled the whole country together and made himself the ruler, he banned the use of the very weapons that he had used to overthrow all the previous regime. Why? He didn't want to be overthrown. And this lasted until about 1850. And in 1850, Commodore Perry came sailing into the harbor of Tokyo with something the Japanese had never seen before. It was the first ship they'd ever seen that could go against the wind.
I see.
Because it was a steamboat. It was the first ship they'd ever seen with artillery. I mean, remember, the Japanese and the Chinese invented the cannon.
I see.
The Japanese were the first to copy the cannon. They'd had cannon for a long time. But there was new metallurgy, probably brass and all kinds of stuff, that the Europeans were using to make their cannon that gave their cannon a range twice as great as the range of the artillery of the Japanese. Well, the Japanese figured they could never be conquered. I mean, they were the best Bushido blade users in the world. They didn't just chop up sushi in ways that are astonishing. They chopped up their fellow human beings in ways that were astonishing. They invented Zen and the art of killing the other guy with a sword. But when the Americans showed up under Perry, Perry's ship, when he didn't get what he wanted and nobody took him seriously in Japan, he went off to stand off the shore of some daimyo's castle, some lord's huge fortified castle, which had its own cannon, for God's sakes. No way you could possibly attack that. And he didn't have to depend on the wind to position himself exactly where he wanted to be. And he didn't have to get within firing range of the Japanese artillery. He could simply point his cannon at the daimyo's castle and level it. Level it. Okay. So the Japanese, until approximately 1860, had been this primitive people who were not on the map of modern weaponry. And in 1860 to 1870, the Japanese decided, oh, my God, if we're going to beat these Europeans and keep them from carving us up like a melon, which is what they had done to the Chinese right next door, we're going to have to develop modern weaponry. And we're going to have to, and it's not just the weaponry that makes the West successful. It's their whole system. The Japanese were the first to really perceive that you can't just take one element from a culture. You have to take the whole culture in order to put the weaponry in its context and continue to get ahead of the enemy. So they sent representatives to the United States, to Germany, to England, and to France to find out what this whole complex of culture was that allowed the Westerners to have such incredible technology. And they took the legal system from France, of all places. They took the parliamentary system from Britain. They took the school uniforms from the Prussians, from the Germans. God knows what they got from the Americans, chewing gum, probably. And they started a modern war technology industry, but they'd only started it in 1870 to 1880. By the time the Tsar had his problem of who in the world was going to pummel into the ground that would be an easy target, they'd only been modernizing for 25 or 35 years. So they were obviously a pushover. They were too new to the modern era for a modern industrial country, because that's what Russia was becoming very rapidly. A modern industrial country with huge armies was obviously going to wipe them off the face of the earth. So the Tsar took his entire Baltic fleet and sent it down over all the way over to the Pacific to take on the Japanese. I mean, he knew he had warships nobody could beat because the Japanese were still primitives. They were just 25 years away from using Bushido blades, from using swords. And when his fleet got there, and this is almost every boat in his navy, when his fleet got there, the Japanese had not only mastered the art of making warships, modern warships, but like everything else the Japanese have ever done, they'd made them better than the originals. And the Japanese wiped out the Russian navy. Only four ships limped out of that confrontation, and they were limping so badly they were never useful for anything again. They had to be tossed away. So where did the land component of the Russo-Japanese war come from? Where okay. they were getting out of the
so
trenches and being mowed down?
So everything you're saying I've read about, but yeah. it was on the side of my brain.
Right.
It wasn't what I was focusing on. What I was focusing on was the element of what the British said was that the reason the Japanese were great was because of their spiritual willingness to sacrifice their lives, and that we are getting soft. So even with all that technology, the reason they won on the ground was because they kept on sending them. They had what we would call, before I studied World War One, we would say, oh, the Asians don't have respect for human life, right? They're willing to die, whereas we are, until you read about World War One and then you read about Hitler and you realize the Western people have been the most prodigious dyers, but we don't acknowledge it in the same way. Kamikaze pilots, it's clear they are dying for the emperor. A paper for the book that I was putting together on war and sacrifice, nationalism, war, and sacrifice. The Japanese wrote a paper on, on that guy that committed suicide, the wrestler Mishimo or something, remember him?
I don't.
There was a famous, a famous writer that committed suicide in name of their emperor. He wrote this.
And by the way, Richard is pointing to his gut because when Japanese committed suicide, they took a knife and they slit themselves their gut open right. and literally spilled their guts.
What did they call it?
Seppuku.
Seppuku. Okay. So he wrote this paper for my book. And I said, this is great. But really, could you tell me why all these people were so willing to die for the emperor? It may be self-evident to you, but we don't understand that completely. And he kind of laughed at me. He said, come on, we didn't need to do what Hitler did. We didn't have to make such great speeches and persuade the people. It was automatic. There's nothing to be explained. And I said, I still would like to have it explained. But in other words, this willingness to die for the emperor in that society was so self-evident that you didn't need to have those mass rallies to persuade people to join. That's what he told me.
Amazing.
Well, it goes to something that Howard and I have talked about on this show in the past, where aliens among us, it's an alien concept to us here in Western civilization, this concept of blind allegiance to a force we don't see. Same with the Muslim concept.
Now, say that again.
A blind allegiance.
I would like to write that down.
Yeah, a blind allegiance to a force we can't see and understand.
You ever seen a country?
No. And have we ever seen, have I ever seen a religion? I've seen religious texts. I've seen the Quran. I've seen the Torah. I've seen Bibles. But I've never seen religion. I've never seen
God. Well, you're talking about God.
Yeah. I've never seen God.
Yeah.
But I've seen people worship gods.
Yeah.
So I've seen, Muslims. I've never seen Allah. And yet people who are devoted to Allah have killed and been killed in the name of Allah.
Right.
And to die for Allah is unquestionable in their belief. And yet to me, that is an alien concept. I was born Jewish. I'm not practicing Jewish, but I still have Jewish tenets within me. And still spiritual. But to die for my Judaism, That's a concept I...
Well, we don't die for religion anymore. And again, this gets back to my main problem.
Yes.
An alien concept. Yeah. Another, it's alien, it's like Galileo. World War I, 9 million people killed, 27 million wounded or missing, and we don't die for alien objects. We're rational people. Hmm. We are the most religious people, but the item that we worship has yet not been deconstructed. Hmm. We have deconstructed femininity and masculinity, but countries, what about countries? Do you know what a country is? When somebody's dying for a country, I mean, define what the French were dying for. They weren't dying for the political leaders. They were dying for some abstract alien entity.
Right.
Which we take self-evident. That's the problem.
And
we
which
all
was,
know what countries are.
And we think countries are a natural part of human life, but in fact, they're an invention. They were invented in the 1500s and 1600s. Until then, we didn't have what we call countries.
There were empires. Some people argue even later.
Yeah.
With the French Revolution.
Right.
But there was something like the body politic, you know, early in Christianity. There's a book by Kantorowicz, and he says that the idea of the body politic comes from the body of the church. You were talking about the bonding, right?
Right.
All the, you know that passage from St. Paul?
Yes.
We are one, and we are many, and we are one.
Right.
Hitler fulfills St. Paul's fantasy of all people being bound together in one body.
Right.
So there weren't exactly countries, but there was the idea of a body politic, and Kantorowicz shows that martyrdom for the country grew directly out of martyrdom for the church.
The big question here is how these sacrifices of 200,000 or 2 million people or 20 million people bond a group together. And I'll give you a guess, a hypothesis.
Okay.
Your body is 100 trillion cells.
Okay.
They could each survive independently. They've got everything it takes to survive independently. But instead, they stick together as this giant clump of 100 trillion cells. Now, somehow, even though no single cell has the least comprehension whatsoever of what Richard Königsberg is, a personality, they have no concept of your personality. They have no concept of your mind. They have no concept of what abstraction in your mind is, what thinking is. Yet they all contribute to it somehow. Well, we humans are individuals in a superorganism, a bigger body. And we contribute to a personality we never get to see, the same way that your blood cells have no clue as to what a Richard Königsberg is. And the only time we get a sense of what that overarching collective personality that we all contribute to making is when we dedicate ourselves to something higher than ourselves.
That's what Leslie White called the superorganic. Now, by
right.
the way, Hitler called Jews bacteria. You're aware of that image
yeah.
that he constantly used, the virus and bacteria, the
right.
Jewish bacteria.
Right.
And now
and
what
vermin.
Did that mean?
Yeah.
They were the part of the cellular structure that didn't contribute.
Right.
That was going on its own, like
right.
an individual. You talked about individuality
mm-hmm.
going off on its own.
Well, that would be a cancer.
Yes, he used cancer. His mother died of cancer.
Really? Yep. Amazing.
And he transferred that directly onto the country.
Right.
That no one can, no one must say to me. 49 is not an age where somebody should die. You can't tell me my mother has cancer. 30 years later, Germany cannot die. That no one can, must today.
Very
Germany must live.
Yeah.
Even if an operation has only 1% of cure, we must remove the cancer. So Germany must live.
Right. Well, let me give you one more guess as to why this is a bonding force, why the deaths of massive numbers of people is a bonding force. Once upon a time, a bunch of social psychologists took a huge group of college girls and divided it into two. One group, they gave a description of a club. And in order to get into that club, all you had to do was sign a piece of paper. And the girls decided to join the club and they signed a piece of paper. And then when it came time for the first club meeting, nobody showed up. The second group, they described exactly the same club. By the way, they deliberately fashioned this group to be useless. The second group of girls, they told about the club and they said, but in order to get into the club, you're going to have to go through 6 months of initiation rituals. So they put these poor girls through 6 months of all kinds of hell. And at the end of the 6 months, they had the first meeting. Now, remember, When the first meeting was called of the group that the girls who just signed a piece of paper to get in were supposed to be a part of, nobody showed up. When they had the first meeting for this group of girls who'd been through the 6 month, months of initiation in order to get into a club that was utterly useless, guess who showed up? Just about everybody. Mm. The greater the amount of investment you make in something, the greater your bonding.
And what was the investment?
The investment was 6 months of initiation rituals.
And these were painful.
And no, they weren't necessarily painful. You can't do that to college students.
Okay.
But they could be traumatic or intimate experiences with each other or vulnerable experiences.
They were time-consuming, difficult experiences.
Yeah, of course.
Right. And that means that people had put in dozens of hours of going through all kinds of difficulty in order to get into this group. So again, the amount of investment you make correlates with the amount of attachment you feel.
Well, it's like basic training.
Yeah, right.
I mean, exactly. You know, it's like putting people through the suffering in order to commit to the object for which you are suffering for. And by the way, Renan, one of the great writers on nationalism about 150 years ago, he says it's experiences of suffering together that holds a nation together in crises. So America, right, you know, America is now falling apart, I would say, but in some way, that's a good thing. I know you're optimistic about it. You know, it's a lousy thing. There's a mess going on, right? But the fact that we have abandoned people sometimes, you know, people that have worked with me and think I'm going to change the world, peace types. Oh, what happens after there's no more sacrifice? I mean, live with, okay, I don't know. You know, I mean, that just means we're not going to have these massive wars anymore because people recognize that this is what they're doing. That's, and there's another scholar that writes about this. Her name is Carolyn Marvin, and she calls it the totem secret. And that means that the secret is that we are held together by blood. It's a secret. So I've been spending these last 10 years trying to expose the secret. The fact that I can go on the radio now and talk about it is real progress. I can say that, that we purposely, in some sense, sacrifice young men in order to recreate this idea of whatever you want to call that thing above us. So we have, after the Vietnam War, we started to abandon this idea. And that's what happened in the 90s. And you had miserable things like, you know, miserable entertain Diane, OJ, stuff like this.
Who's that? Oh, you mean Princess Diane?
What?
Princess Diane?
Yeah, I mean, there was other diversions. You
right.
know, just before 9/11, and I lectured on this at the Church Center of the UN. The big issue was Anne Heche and...
Who's Anne Heche?
Anne Heche and Ellen DeGeneres.
They were the girlfriend,
the lesbian girlfriend. And when 9/11 came about, you would be amazed at a lot of the writing from the more conservative. Ah, now the newspapers are writing about real things. Anne Heche, and they're relegated. Nobody cares about that shit anymore. And they were so happy. Now the real history comes back,
yeah.
The violence and the dying, because this is real history. So we brought this back. Bin Laden brought it back. In other words, people didn't like the end of history,
right?
The end of dying and killing, because
right.
there was no meaning. It was empty.
Well, look, our task is to find other means to cement a culture together, to bond people to each other without the sacrifice of killing. Without the sacrifice of murder, without the sacrifice of death.
Well, again, the idea, I mean, let's say to relate. Cement, I don't like, because that has to do with that's what Hitler used terms like that,
right.
Smelting together, the
right.
melting pot.
Right.
It implies the abrogation of individuality. So let's say ways that human beings can connect with each other, can relate.
Well, I'm just using traditional terms. I mean, and traditional terms, remember, I've written 6 books, so I'm using the terminology of my books.
Okay.
But Here's a possibility, see if this makes any sense. In the 1960s, John F. Kennedy, aside from sleeping with every woman that he found the least bit attractive, did something remarkable.
Allegedly,
yes.
Proven, but
yeah,
allegedly.
Right. But John F. Kennedy said, what was that line of his? Ask not what you can do for what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
So, yeah.
And then he, I believe it was, put together the Peace Corps.
Right.
And he presented, theoretically, an alternative form of sacrifice, giving 2 years of your life or more in some strange place to help other humans. The question is, can that kind of nonviolent sacrifice have the same bonding power as blood, as death, as murder?
But the question is whether nationalism and politics in any sense is on the cutting edge. Look at what we're doing now. This does not have to do with the country. This has to do with the internet revolution. Everything you're able to do with your podcast, right, everything I'm able to do with my newsletters is due to the internet revolution. So, you know, what our country, look at this guy Assad. I mean, who needs a leader killing his own people? Maybe the next advances in human civilization will not come from these entities called countries, like the internet revolution. The things we're able to do now because of the, and you know, young people, Orion, he don't care about this shit. That's one reason he can work with me. He's not threatened by any of these ideas. He don't care about countries.
This is a person, Orion is a person who works for Richard and is a contact person for Richard.
He's a young person and he does the
website.
How old
is Orion?
And he's able to work with me very easily because he doesn't see my ideas as radical because he could care less about these issues of countries and sacrifice. There's many young people like that that don't participate in politics. And we don't hear about them because still the, what do they call it? The mainstream media, they are still, people still want to link up with that. That is the center. People still want a center. But this can be a center. I can be a center. You can be a center. Why do we have to assume the center is O'Reilly and whoever all those pathetic cats are?
What would you suggest as an alternative center once the nation melts away?
What if there is each person like a Zen? Each person is their own center.
Because we will lose our civilization and our every freedom that you and I take for granted, that the three of us in this room take for granted, is premised on living within that larger superorganism of Western civilization.
Well, you said too, you said civilization and freedom. Are they this new lady I just hired, who works for me, she calls herself an anarchist. I mean, is civilization and freedom go together? I mean, civilization, by the way, is what caused all those deaths in World War I. Every country said consciously, the Germans said, we are fighting for the future of civilization. We cannot let those shopkeepers in Great Britain take over. Great Britain said, we are fighting for the future of civilization. We cannot let those Teutonic sadists take over. Germany said, we are fighting for the future of civilization. Hitler, and here's a story, you know, they said, here's a beautiful French woman. You can have sex with, you're going to have sex with a French woman? You're going to violate your... So
you mean you're going to violate your own purity by having sex with one of these subhumans?
Yeah.
Is that what was that?
Yeah,
what
something like that. Something like that. So I'm saying the whole idealization of civilization is one of my problems in presenting these ideas. Because if you look at, quote, civilization, this lady that's working for me, she believes in communism. And I, well, what has communism done? 40 million in China, 25 million, 30 million in Russia. So
killed.
Is
Dead.
Civilization always a positive force? It certainly wasn't in World War I. It certainly wasn't in World War II. Freedom is another issue.
Yeah, but I look at civilization in some regards as a mandate. I mean, we need a civilization. We need a system of laws, right? We need a red light to be a red light. We need to know that if I'm crossing the street and it's my turn to cross the street, I can cross the street. We need to know that when I go to a restaurant, that the food I'm eating is safe for me to eat. We need a series of standards by which to live. We can't live in that world. Now, I know there are a lot of people that want to say, fuck it all, and let's just see where the chips may land, but we can't live in that world.
But is civilization, is law, and rules have to do with worshiping the nation. You can have laws and structures that guide your existence without having this thing that you have to die for.
But you and I and Howard can create our own set of laws. But that doesn't mean that the person on the street corner is going to have those own set of laws. So we need a guiding force that we're all going to abide by.
But it's not a force. I mean, in New York City, okay? I mean, I made a slip of the tongue once, or a colleague of mine made a slip of the tongue. Yeah. Instead of dying for the country, he wrote dying for the county.
Right.
And you, did anybody ever think of a war between Essex County and Hudson County in New Jersey? So does Mayor, what was the last mayor? Mayor Bloomberg? Mm. Is he going to fight? There was all kind of laws in New York City.
Right.
But Manhattan, we don't fight it. Manhattan doesn't fight Queens. Law is not dependent on worship of the nation.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a little different argument than I'm making. It's the anarchist argument.
No, I'm not an anarchist.
Okay. That's a little different then. All right. I just want to get some clarity on that as just for foundational conversation here. Laws are necessary. I believe some.
Well, I'm not saying you abandon civilization.
Right.
We have civilization.
Right.
I just happen to focus my life, because most people don't, on studying this destructive part of civilization.
But there are countries that are the size of New York City. You know, I mean, well, the Vatican, if you want to call that, it's even smaller. But there are countries that are very tiny. Mm-hmm. Belgium is the size of what is Belgium the size of? I think it's the size of New Jersey or something like that. There are countries that are very, very small.
It's the size of a Big Mac.
Yeah, I am hungry. So my point is this. So where do you draw the line? So if you're going to say abandon the state of a nation, America.
Well, the nation as an idol. They don't fight Europe. You know how many people died in Europe in the Second World War?
And I'm not disagreeing with you.
100 million.
Right.
Belgium doesn't want to fight wars anymore.
No.
France doesn't want. They learned their lesson.
Yeah. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just arguing with you to have that counter-argument.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying the definition of civilization does not necessarily mean having this sacrificial attitude toward the country. And things could have worked out a lot better for many civilizations if they had, although in some way it started like that, with the Egyptians, all right? The first civilization began with essentially a sacrificial project. Imagine how the Egyptian people could have lived if they didn't have to spend 60% of their lives and revenue building this fantasy to the Pharaoh's immortality.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of diverting your society's energy toward useless things, which seem the most important thing in the world, is at the beginning. Would have we ever become civilized if we hadn't had these monumental structures?
Those monuments set the level of aspiration for a culture that managed through all the bonding mechanisms that we're talking about.
Exactly.
To survive for 5,000 years. That's a long time.
And as a society, and I can say this as a sports fan, there are still cities that are still building these monuments in the form of tax-burdened stadia.
Exactly.
And arenas that are bankrupting cities in the name of civic pride.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The idea, this narcissistic need to be big or to be great. And that's a good example. My wife is Chinese, and she can't understand it. You know, why we have a defense budget of 45%. She says, why don't they use those schools?
45%? Why did I miss that? 45% of what?
The total.
You mean the total amount of the federal budget?
Yeah, what is it?
Okay. It's approximately 3.5% of our gross domestic product right now. But it's the size of, depending on whose statistics you're looking at, and this is from the last week, it's either the size of the next 7 biggest budgets combined or the size of the next 14 biggest budgets from other countries combined. So we have by far the biggest defense budget in the world.
And she says, you know, why not build schools in Harlem? I can't explain it to her that, whoa, we're the greatest country in the world. We need a defense department. We're big. We're powerful. We can kill anybody. That, you know, that's a fantasy. So all that energy and all that money is diverted from, and it is related to stadium because it's a narcissism. You call it binding, but it's also the idea that we're so powerful. We want to identify with something great and something big.
Well, I think that's crucial. I think, first of all, we don't have any freedom. It's like a bacteria trying to declare its independence from the food in the petri dish. If you remove the petri dish and the food, that bacteria is dead, period. The petri dish is our culture. And without a huge infrastructure we don't see, an infrastructure of ideas, an infrastructure of habits below on the muscular level. Think of the way you walk down the street. You automatically thread between people in a complex dance. And if you didn't have that dance down pat, you would lose your shoulders. You would lose your arms because you'd be bumping into people all the time. We couldn't have people on the sidewalk. That's an infrastructure of habit without which even pedestrianism, walking down the street, couldn't exist. Well, this culture is a weave of infrastructure, of habits and concepts like this. And it's only through the development of this culture, which has taken 2,500 years minimum to develop a secular culture like the one that we've got. It's only through that huge multi-generational history that we're able to experience what we call freedom. Because if we lived in Bangladesh, if we lived in Pakistan, if we lived in one of the 57 Islamic countries of the world where they don't have that infrastructure of ideas, even though they've absorbed a lot from us, you would be hacked to death in the street, Richard. I would be hacked to death in the street. And Chad, they might have mercy on Chad.
They'd hack me. If you saw my tattoos, I'd get hacked.
Well, yeah. But, you know, I mean, the people, you know, the lack of freedom in those countries. I was very friendly with several Muslims before all this stuff came on. You know, Pakistani and Bangladeshi, the men I knew very well, were the most gentle people I ever met in my life. Now, the reason they don't like our, what was the big complaint? Shafiq Nazumi. He went out with America.
Who was that?
He's the Muslim guy that I befriended when I was studying Asian Indian culture,
right.
From Pakistan.
Right.
He taught me Urdu for a year. And he was pretty modern for a Pakistani, right? He went out with an American woman, which was almost unheard of. What don't these South Asians like about American women?
I don't know. What?
No idea.
What can they do?
Peroxide.
What did your wife do?
Speak English, drive a car.
What else?
A lot of things.
Shopping.
She worked, had
they
a job.
They can break up with you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, guy separation, divorce.
Finally, with all his love of American women and culture, his father got him a wife. Couldn't bear the idea that a woman say, I don't want to go out with you.
Yeah, freedom.
Couldn't bear it.
And freedom to leave.
That's what the underpinning of the lack of belief. I mean, you know, if you could have a woman that has to obey you and you can get a beautiful woman, highly educated, and you just have to snap your finger and your father will send out your resume, no work, no wandering around the city for years to find your true love. There's a real enlage of lack of freedom that they like. They have contempt for us. I met a guy at the mall the other day. He was selling your lottery tickets to all these Dominicans and very poor people. And I could see he's so arrogant, you know, he's looking down at them. And then he looked at me and he didn't know what to think. I was buying a New York Times. They only have 4 copies of the New York Times in Elmer's. And he didn't know whether, you know, because Indian, you're either on top or the bottom. And I just look equally to him. And then he didn't know whether they hate me or like me. Next time I came back and I said to him, oh, you shouldn't be so contemptuous of these people. They don't have arranged marriages.
Yes, well, the fact is that every society, every culture, and every subculture defines itself by a bunch of arbitrary little practices and then hates people who don't abide by those practices. In a book in which a couple of adventurers decided to take a trip across the whole Hejaz, the whole Saudi Arabian desert on camel, and they had a Saudi Arabian guide to make sure that they didn't get lost and die in the middle of the desert. And they came across a town that didn't require its women to wear veils. Their guide thought that town was so primitive, it should be wiped off the face of the map, because in his experience, all the time he was growing up, at the age of 1, 2, and 3 years old, women always had veils when they were outside of the house, period. So he felt that that was a fundamental aspect of morals, of ethics, of gentility, of manners. And these people had no manners. So we absorb these huge masses of infrastructure of habit. And that is a major part of our culture. And we look down on people who don't have that infrastructure of habit. But right now, my second book, Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century. First of all, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, with his enormous defense budget, threw a forum based on one of my books. He could afford the money, apparently, and brought in people from the Energy Department, the State Department, DARPA, IBM, and MIT. And that book says that it talks about intergroup tournaments. It says that groups are constantly in competition with each other. And those groups that don't do well in the competition die. They are die or they are taken over by other groups. And right now we're going through a competition like that, an intergroup tournament between China, Islam, militant Islam, but Muhammad's own form of Islam was militant, period, and Western civilization. In Western civilization, there are things that you value. You've shown in this conversation that you value the idea of freedom enormously. And we don't realize that if we wipe away the petri dish, the civilization within which we live, if the Chinese succeed in shattering this petri dish, if the
militant Muslims... You don't have to worry about the Chinese. There's political candidates now that are advocating the abolition of freedom.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to like to get into politics,
right.
But I mean, it's not like the Chinese. The Chinese have a dictatorship, okay? They have a tyranny, and they're taking over
and
Hong
they
Kong.
Don't have what we call freedom of speech.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
No.
Right now in Turkey, Erdogan, the leader, this is a Muslim country, has made it illegal to insult him, which means you can't criticize him.
I've read about
him.
All these oppressive forces in the world. It's very powerful.
Well, and militant Islam feels that by sending suicide bombers into cities like Paris or New York, or Washington, it can eventually turn us Muslim.
Not going to persuade me.
Well, they're not going to persuade me either.
But they think so, by the way. That's the idea. So getting back to your business about enemies. So we didn't discuss the other side of the coin of the idealized object was the unbeliever, the enemy.
Right.
So I wrote my recent piece on the Jew as an infidel because they didn't, in Hitler's mind, they didn't love the country enough. I hate to be simple-minded. This is 40 years of research. But essentially, they were non-willing to sacrifice for the country. They didn't love Germany enough. And the same dynamic is for them. We are the infidels. And in their mind, Allah is an absolute. So they're blowing up the World Trade Center. The idea was that we're going to show you how powerful we are and how much we believe in our God. And we're punishing you infidels who will die for our God. As I say, I wasn't persuaded.
Right. Well,
you weren't persuaded, but that act went a long way for uniting Muslims in the cause. So while you weren't persuaded, it did do a lot to unite the cause, the other half of the coin. You have to recognize that.
And the other half of the coin is the United Americans. Because look what happened after that. George Bush,
yes.
You know, that State of the Union address,
yes,
suddenly he's the king, this small man.
Yeah, King George, yeah.
And he's going to wipe out. And then he decided to kill in the name of what? Freedom and democracy.
And he decided to start a war in Iraq that we should probably have never started.
But if you look at the documents, what I do, I study texts.
Yeah.
I study the language. Just like with Hitler, I studied George Bush.
Mm.
His main idea was, now we can sacrifice again.
Absolutely.
We had lost all our morals. This could be a good thing. We're going to learn the value of sacrifice. And that was what he promoted for 3 years. And that morphed into freedom and democracy. Norman Podoritz, remember that? That cat
mm-hmm.
with his wife. Everybody in the Middle East wants exactly what we want, which is freedom. Who said? You know what Islam means?
It means submission.
Exactly.
Becoming a slave to the will of Muhammad and Allah.
Can you imagine a man fighting a war who doesn't even know that?
Whoops, microphone.
Can you imagine that? Starting a war.
Richard's getting so excited that he's
freedom
departing
and
from his
democracy
microphone. Yeah.
To people whose basic ideology is submission. Of course it hasn't worked.
And what any good Muslim on the jihadist side of things will tell you is they loathe and despise our freedom. They loathe and despise our democracy. Why? Because we should be slaves to God, not this crazy idea of freedom, and because laws should not be made by men in parliaments or congresses. There only one creature has a right to make laws. It's God himself.
That's exactly right.
And God has given us his set of laws through Muhammad and his example, and that's an absolute. And anybody who fails to live by those laws is the worst kind of.
And there's one other variable, and this comes down to your writing on the importance of sexuality, which I did listen to that piece you did. Hopefully I'm going to be having sex too when I'm 90. You've given me permission.
Hopefully I'll have someone when I'm 44, but let's...
Okay. My lovely wife, Meha Chan, who's the one who enables me to do all this scholarly work by being a great businesswoman. Hello there, Meha. Right. How are you? Okay. So when this happened, 9/11, and she's not a scholar, she's not intellectual, what did she say? Britney Spears, Britney Spears, Britney Spears.
And why? What was the connection? I don't understand.
All of this stuff that we have is being piped in to these countries some way or another by video. And so these men have the domination over their way. They wear all these clothes. Like we were saying, they submit. So our entire culture with its freedom is encouraging the opposite. What did the guys in 9/11 do the night before they did what they did?
They went to porn palaces or something of the sort.
Strip clubs, I think.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's a temptation. So this is, again, the other side of the coin. This is not an absolute where you only are one thing. The other side of wanting to submit is their wish for freedom, their wish to see nude women. And the other side of our freedom, as we see in our recent culture, is our wish to be dominated or to dominate others. So there's a dialectic between these two impulses.
There's a Bloomian concept, and let's see if I can describe it.
Okay.
Imagine a globe with longitude lines on it. That's the globe of myth. Every society has a globe of myth. Okay. And at the North Pole, there is what we aspire to be, what our highest values are. And at the South Pole is the things we loathe the most. At the North Pole is those people we want to model ourselves after, Thomas Jefferson, for example, with the exception of his habit of sleeping with his slaves. At the South Pole are the bad guys. And we aspire to go to the North Pole to emulate that which is at the top, that which represents our ideals, those people who represent our ideals, and we aspire to eradicate the people at the South Pole, the evil ones, the bad guys. Now, for us, freedom and democracy is at the North Pole. For jihadist Muslims, freedom and democracy is at the South Pole and is the most vicious, vile, sinful thing, force of corruption on earth, is the phrase that's used in Islam all the time, you can possibly imagine. So our ideals are their devil, are their Satan, are their sins. And our and their ideals are our Satan and sin.
Exactly. It's a dialect. But I have a new lady that working for me now, by the way, Kimberly Baxter. Hello, Kimberly. And we talked a lot about the projection of doubt into the infidel. And this I studied a lot for Hitler. So Hitler didn't get married his entire life, right? Because he was so devoted to Germany. You know when he did get married?
As he was about to kill himself.
Right.
When he was in the bunker at the very end.
When Germany had lost the war. Yeah. And what did he say? Now that I have no leading to do, I can finally marry a real woman, because he was married to Germany. So what I'm suggesting is that there is a dialectic, his own individuality, his own being oppressed by the Germany he loved. And he wanted to overthrow that. So I'm saying and he projected that onto the Jew. The Jew was like the American for the infidel. They were the ones that wanted freedom and individuality and to be separate from the country and the group. Now, they would have joined up willingly if he had let them. But he needed that object, as you say, to represent the South Pole that then he could fight against. But what was he fighting against? He was fighting against his own wish to abandon Germany and to be an individual and to not be connected to his mother.
Well, there's another Bloomian concept, and it's not in any of my books, unfortunately. But first you find a scapegoat that's too weak to resist you, and you orient your people toward hating it and expelling it in order to purify your society. Once you've galvanized your society, bonded them together on the basis of getting rid of this little group that can't resist you, can't defend itself from you, then you've established the kind of firm bond between your followers that allows you to go on and take on other powers your own size. There are two examples of this. I mean, there are probably more, but the two that I'm very aware of are these. Hitler's Germany, which used the Jews as the force too small to fight back. and Muhammad's Islam, which used the Jews for exactly the same purposes, kicking the hell out of Jewish group after Jewish group after Jewish group after Jewish groups, even though it was Jews who originally gave Muhammad a place in which to live, the town of Medina, Yathrib, which was later renamed Medina.
Only one problem with this hypothesis, Howard, yes, is that from Goebbels and Hitler's point of view, even though I agree with you, the Jews were actually helpless and weak. And that's something I can't convince people of. Oh, they must have done something. There must be some reason for it. I asked people, how many Jews were in Germany in 1933 out of 63 million Germans? I mean, I don't know. Can you want to take a guess since you're the general public?
I would say, well, we knew there were 6 million Jews that died in World War II in the camps. I would say of how many those, how many were German? 2.5 million?
Okay, there was actually 550,000. So in all and I get guesses from educated people, 5 million, 10 million. Why? Because they can't believe that they did nothing. They did nothing.
Yeah.
Please, I don't want to debate it.
Yes.
I've studied it for 20 years. There was no reason to kill. However, the thing is, in Hitler's and Goebbels' mind, and if you read the literature, the more recent literature on that, they didn't think that. They thought the Jews were all powerful. They claimed Roosevelt was Jewish. They claimed Stalin was Jewish. And that's why they ganged together. So if you read the literature on the war, the reason they went to war was because even though they were, quote, inferior, they thought, and this is called paranoia. And if you study Schreiber or, you know, these documents on paranoia, they believed the Jews were all powerful and they were the destructive force. They were the ones that were causing Germany to fall apart. So that word, Zersetzung, a German
word.
What
does that mean?
What?
What's Zersetzung?
The force of disintegration.
Aha. Okay. Well, and how do you, the fact is that Muhammad used attacks on Jews who were too small to resist him over and over and over and over again to bond the Muslims and to enrich them. Because he took all of their treasure. He took all of their goods. He took all of their land. He took all of the fruits of their land.
Well, you also told me he took their women.
And he took their women. Yes, I forgot to mention that.
I don't know that historical case study.
Yeah.
But what I have found is that when you study the underlying documents, this is my methodology, what these people say, it's very different than what it appears. Again, getting back to that Galileo image. Now, I challenge people, you know, everybody think he went to Soviet Union to conquer. I challenge people to
wait. Who went to the Soviet Union?
The Germans tried to conquer.
Oh,
the,
yes,
that's
right,
the way
right,
it appears,
right.
Right? I challenge you. You can try and do a search in Mein Kampf. If he used that word once,
conquer?
Any of his speeches,
which
not
one?
Once.
Conquer?
Never.
Yeah.
He thought that he was being oppressed by the Jew, that the Jews were going to destroy the world. And if he didn't destroy the Jews first, they were going to destroy him.
And guess who else believes the same thing today? The jihadists.
Yeah.
Or Osama bin Laden, the one who said you were the worst civilization in the history of mankind because you don't believe in God, you don't use God's laws, Sharia. And then he gave a long list of other things, which he equated all of our sexuality with prostitution, letting women have naked faces, letting women wear short dresses. All of these things bothered him. But the other thing that bothered him was he felt the world was controlled by Zionists, which is a crazy idea because there are approximately 15 million Jews in the world today, and that's less than the population of just one of Muslim's cities, one of the 250 major Muslim cities in the world, Cairo. That's less than the population of Cairo. And yet, in Iran, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a false document created by the Tsar's Okhrana when he lost to the Japanese in order to get people to take it out, take their frustrations out on the Jews, not on him, not on the Tsar. That phony book purports to be the notes of a meeting of Jewish elders who get together periodically to plot all of the depressions, all of the economic crashes, and all of the wars in the world. That's an absurd, appalling notion. And yet that book, which is one of the most popular books in the Islamic world, and it was turned into a television series in Iran. Mm-hmm. So it is taken for granted that this is the case, that these 15 million people somehow have these astonishing powers. There are 180 Muslims for every Jew on this planet. That's a rather overwhelming mass.
You know, I remember Western people, you and everybody, are basically belief in rationality. So I've reached the point in my life where I don't argue with what I call psychotic cultural ideas. You're right. What you just said is true, that they believe that. But the notion, I don't argue with psychotic beliefs anymore. I did at the beginning. Oh, how can you say that? There's so many things. This lady that's working with me, Kimberly, I said the other day, everything is nothing. What I mean by that is that there's so many ideas that people put out there that have no foundation whatsoever. Now you, I love the way you're fighting these ideas, but my notion is look at them as not, I use the word more and more nonsense. So of course that's nonsense. So just like the Jew, if you read some of the writings about the Jews by Goebbels, you think he was a psychotic. And Daniel Goldnagel, who wrote his famous book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, he says it looks like the rantings of mental patients. But that people are unwilling to say that. That's what I would like to leave with the audience to the extent I have any influence whatsoever, is that entire cultural ideas can be psychotic, even though they're embraced by it. The fact that a society embraces something and believes it, just like everybody believed that the sun revolved around the earth, it can be entirely wrong. And yet, at a certain moment in history, that idea has to be overturned. But looking back on it, you know, and I'm sure there are still people that believe the earth is flat, believe in witches. There's a lot of things in our society that everybody believes that are basically like what you're saying about the power of Zionism.
And yet, when what you're implying, and I think it's very true, is when enough people believe in it, it becomes a historical force and needs to be taken seriously
exactly.
and opposed.
That's all. My whole work is studying these nonsensical historical forces that generate history. So you could say history is a sequence of these kind of events that people take seriously that generate massive destruction that have no foundation in actual reality, like that the Jews were going to conquer Germany and that they were going to such a force. And Hitler felt that within his body.
And again, what you've demonstrated in your work is that we have to take psychotic ideas seriously. And if they gain sufficient social momentum, it is our job to oppose them.
Well,
if we don't develop an equivalent social momentum or greater social momentum, those ideas will crush and destroy us.
Well, you're right. It's happening right now. But that's not my job. My job is to lay out the science of it, right?
Right?
I'm a science of ideology to show
right.
how it works. One guy that was working with me, he was a peace activist, and I had a whole booklet. He was sponsoring me. I gave a lecture for $5,000. And after a while, it was like, the Iraq war is not ending. Oh, our work is useless. And I said, why? Did you really think Dick Cheney was going to be reading and listening to my lectures? So there's, you know, yes, many people have to speak. I want to show the sickness of it.
And if people want to see your exposés of the sickness, where can people find out more about your work, Richard?
Okay, just go to the Library of Social Science website.
And that is libraryofsocialscience.com?
That's it, yep.
And you've written some books as well?
I've written my most recent book is called Nations Have the Right to Kill. It's about our belief that nations have the right to kill.
Mm.
And we allow that. So it is not a war crime. People talk about war crimes. It's not a war crime if everybody believes that a nation has the right to kill.
Right. In fact, and we're running really over, but I want to get this. There's a recent court case coming up right now where somebody in the army or somebody in our active military is going after President Obama saying he does not have legal authority to wage a war against ISIS. Have you seen this?
No.
It came out within like the last 48 hours.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting.
But you know, when people get passionate about war, legal things are out the window.
Of course. It's all, so that's interesting.
Nationalism. So one of my papers, by the way, is entitled War as a Collective Psychopathology. So I do have a paper on that idea. But normally I don't use that psychopathology because people don't want to hear that yet. I just demonstrate, like Howard's saying, the absurdity of... I don't even say that. I just lay it out for people to look at. Okay, look at this belief system. Goebbels said, well, we have to fight the Jews because the Jew right now is in the White House and he's sending young men over to kill one of our German soldiers. Right. So once you look at it, it's so absurd. And yet, as you say, people believed in it and it generated history. So that's my topic, how cultural ideas that many people believe in generate history, and they're psychotic if you judge them rationally, but when the entire culture believes them, as you say, they become a force and they're no longer considered psychotic.
Well, I would throw up for consideration the idea that the concept of reason is our own peculiar psychosis, because it's important to look at yourself objectively all the time, too. Even though I believe that we need to oppose these forces that you're talking about with Chinese culture, which is basically totalitarian, and Islamic culture, which is not just totalitarian, but is based on massive, massive, massive murder, we need to look at ourselves critically, too.
And you can you imagine how long it takes to teach a Chinese woman about the idea of freedom?
Oi.
No, I can't. This has been highly educational. Richard, thank you so much for coming in
You're
today.
You're quite welcome. And I appreciate it.
And Howard, always a pleasure. I have a show idea for next time that's going to kind of piggyback off of this. And it's kind of a notion I've been playing with. This is a topic I'm going to choose. Life is empty and meaningless. We give it meaning.
Yes, I think that's a great topic.
And it kind of is going to play right onto this conversation. So that's going to be our next episode. Life is empty and meaningless. And we're going to tackle that next time on Howard Bloom Saves the Universe. Howard, thank you as always.
Thanks, Chad. It's been terrific.
You've been listening to Howard Bloom Saves the Universe with Howard Bloom and Chad Dugatz. To learn more about Howard, visit howardbloom.net. Howard Bloom Saves the Universe is a production of ProMedia and Howard Bloom. Copyright 2015 by Howard Bloom. I'm Matt Tombs.